off the totem. I mean, you're really not buying anything. And that's why I look at it. We've got, right now, 1,130 acres of nothing.
Well, you've got the surface estate.
Well, what good is it? I mean,
okay.
Suppose someone wanted to put a building like this on there. All of a sudden, the city looks and says, hey, we're gonna, we think there might be something down there. We want to dig down there and see if there's any minerals or anything down there, or exploration, whatever you want to call it.
What, this commission won't be going to Huna. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about it. How many people live there?
That's something I can't. I can tell you what was last year.
Yeah.
It was 861. One of the things the corporation has done is, you know, I've heard all kinds of talk. The corporation has done some good in our community through logging. Mm-hmm. But it's also brought in a heck of a lot of people. So I'd say anywhere from 1,000 to 1,400 right now. We haven't had a census taken. It fluctuates darn bad with the seasonal work going on all of a sudden here. So it's really hard to pinpoint an exact census mm-hmm. what we do have out there.
Mm-hmm. How does the municipality get along with the Village Corporation?
Well, within the last year, we're finally working together. The doors are open. In the past, these doors were closed. Everybody was jealous of each other. I mean, we finally got together, and I think we're decided the only way we're going to survive is by working together.
Is there, in many of these places in Alaska, there's a municipal government and village corporation and an IRA council or a traditional council as well. Do you have an IRA council or a traditional council?
Yes, we have an IRA council.
Does it have any real functions? Is it active in any sense?
Yes, it is active. They're geared, in Huna anyway, they're geared more towards, they kind of got out of most things, but they will stick with all your health and social service activities. And they've been pretty good there. They were instrumental in getting us a fire hall over there. They're working on a clinic, a hospital with a doctor in residence. So the IRA is fairly active.
What's the proportion of native to non-native people in Huna?
I would say roughly 80% native.
Mm-hmm. What about the seasonal workers who come in? You indicated that the logging brings an influx of people from time to time.
Yes, it does. We have, Huna Totem has contracted out to what's called Whitestone Log. Before that, they had their own corporation, it didn't work out too good. What they're doing now is they have loggers coming and teaching locals how to work. And I see these outsiders moving out. All they're doing is training the locals.
Mm-hmm.
And as the locals learn, the teachers, so to speak, work themselves out of a job, which I think is pretty good.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for raising that point.
You bet.
I'm trying to get everything I want to say out because I don't know if I'll be able to do this again if there's going to be another commission or not. But I can identify with the mayor there. But he brought up another aspect I had never thought of, that the village corporations, you know, when we had this land selections, a lot of them was taken up by the parks and everything, and we're like Klukwan is inside a park system. So we couldn't get any more land around there for anything. We wanted to expand our village. We can't even do that now because it's all taken up. So they had to go to Long Island to get land selection there. But what happens then is that the local people in the villages that wanted to work with their village corporations, they have to move out of town, move from their home. And then they're limited. A lot of the corporations are limited, so they can't fly their working people back and forth because it costs. So consequently, a lot of them just live down in Ketchikan. And we just lost a few more members just this recently in Klukwan because it cost them too much to fly back and forth. And this is another thing that seems to be separating the people when we have to go that way. But there is another thing on the health and social services that is a good side. It makes me feel good as a search member and a member of the Tlingit tribe in Southeast that we are getting together with the health programs. Pretty, you know, Search is a nonprofit organization, contract service organization, which the board of directors are all members of each village or town in Southeast Alaska. And we're applying to IHS to contract Mount Edgecombe Hospital. And if this happens, then this could be another proven factor that the Native people are getting well educated and starting to take control of their own life.
And self-determination in action.
Right, this self-determination action to let the federal government that we are accountable. And this is a part I wanted to bring out, that we are getting it together. And like I said, the rest of the things seemed like it was a crash course in education of the non-native side or the real world, or I guess that's maybe this is what the thing is all about, just to give us a condensed crash course of education, which we are doing a pretty good job. That's why I wanted to bring up that the health program that we are getting together with that, and it looks real good. And I hope it goes through IHS and then the federal government accepts it, because there's other nations that take care of their own people. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Strong. No one else who wants to say anything this morning. Mr. Willard wants to come at 11:30 and make a presentation. So what we might do is just break for a minute or two and invite all of you to have a cup of coffee. And if Mr. Willard comes, we'll all listen to him. And if he doesn't come, we'll adjourn and go to lunch and come back this afternoon. So help yourselves, please.
Alaska Natives are running the risk of cultural intervention as the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 is being implemented. There appears to be no threat to the cultural identity of Alaska Native people as a result of ANCSA. My name is Robert Willard. I am from Angoon. My mother and father are full-blood Tlingits. I now reside in Juneau, where I serve as Executive Vice President of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. This statement is my own and does not reflect the official position of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. I have served in several capacities, such as Alaska State Trooper, Alaska Legal Services, Alaska Human Rights Commission. I revere, though, my service on the Board of Directors of the Alaska Federation of Natives in 1968, 1969, 1970, in 1971, which was up to and after ANCSA was signed into law by President Nixon. In our southeast region, there does exist strong ties to Beklinkit, Haida, Tsimshian. There is, though, the want to attend to or participate in the new civilization. The new is impinging upon us as natives, if not demanding that we conform to their way of life, but that too is of existence. It is almost as if a new religion is being introduced. We have a Tlingit word for spirit that lives above us. That word in Tlingit has been with us several thousands of years before the Europeans hit our shores. Now I say a new religion. With ANCSA, we are expected to conform with BIA, AFDC, SEC, labor laws, and every program that bears any kind of initial. In a sense, we do so. In practice, we are on the verge of defying our own culture and heritage, which is our true identity. And just to conform with the requisites of the new civilization, ANCSA, at best, is a tool for all of us to work together. Without ANCSA, there are lawyers who would have retired successfully, and the new state of Alaska would still be an outcast of the United States of America. Today, Alaska is no more than a stepchild of the Department of Interior, but that is another story. As to ANCSA and its impact, there are minuses and pluses. There are several factors that lead to this perception. The effect of ANCSA was too abrupt and in cases too gradual. The federal, state agencies, the municipalities, and in many cases our own people were at fault. In the beginning of ANCSA, there were great expectations of our little operations. It had affected the minds of administrators throughout the state. One of the first was the judicial system. The jurists perceived us to be millionaires, what with $1 billion cash settlement and 44 millions of acres. Prosecutors were of no help to my people. Public welfare was very carefully and doubly scrutinized among our native people. The backbone of Alaska education in my region, southeast, was set back 2 years because of the reluctance of agencies that deal in scholarships. The banks and the creditors became a problem. Those creditors who were used to our system of paying little amounts of money on a non-seasonal basis, upon learning of our dividend checks, began to demand full amount payments. As a result, many of our people did not realize the full impact of the dividends of ANCSA. From our side, there were benefits, many casualties. Those of our children with guts and perception of what was to come went to school. Those of ours who hoped waited for the check to come. As a result of ANCSA, the too high expectation caused anxiety too in many cases and damaged careers, marriages, education, and mostly cultural identity. That, among other things. It takes no statistical information, Commissioner, to point out that more of our people, as a result of the reluctance of the public defender system, that are serving time in the jail facilities throughout the state. It takes no statistical information to find out that as a result, there are more divorces among our people. There are more suicidal attempts and more suicides, more homicides, because of the anxiety that has been created. The problem that we're running now is that many of our people are waiting to go to work for the corporations and not taking those jobs within the federal, state, and private sectors. That is the problem that we're running at the present time. If you're going to be returning the information back to your people in your own country, then this is what has happened, as far as I can tell from our perspective.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Willard. I wonder if I could ask you a question. Your experience in this whole field goes back many years, and you are now Executive Vice President of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, so you have wide-ranging contact with Alaska Native people. One of the concerns that many people in the villages have expressed to this commission is that in 1991, if shares in the corporations can be sold, that if enough Native people sell their shares, then they'll lose control of the corporations and therefore lose control of their ancestral lands, which are held by the corporations. Would you care to express any opinion as to what would happen if there were no restrictions on the sale of shares after 1991? Do you think people would sell, or do you think they'd hang on to their shares? Have you any opinion on that?
Yeah, you can liken it to the limited entry commission. Okay, limited entry came to Alaska to provide an opportunity for Alaska people and restrict the number of permits that would be issued for fishermen. Well, I was one of three people that testified against the limited entry system. I think, sadly, that my testimony bore out that in my little village, we had 33 vessels.
That's Angoon.
That's Angoon. Presumably, they would have been eligible for limited entry permits. And there were 17 that qualified under the system. Today, there are only two. I think we're running a danger of losing. See, the problem that would occur were 1991 were not extended is that the perceived intention of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement at all is not going to be realized by those that come after us. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
When was the Limited Entry Commission going around taking testimony? How long ago was that?
That would have been in 1969, 1970. I see the danger of people selling. The corporation, the regional corporation, is of no help, as I can see it. They're not providing the kinds of answers that the people want to hear. I, as an example, I belong to Kutznuwo Corporation, Angoon. I also have 158 shares in Sealask. Can I sell my Kutznu shares and still hand out to Sea Alaska shares, and vice versa? Can I sell my Sea Alaska stock? What effect would it have on the corporation, which has subsurface estate rights, whereas the village corporation does not? Sea Alaska is of no help. They won't give me any answer in that regard. There were many other impacts regarding the action. Many of our people that apply now for credit are running into problems with the banks. I hear it every day, people come to me. The way the legislature deals with our villages, it's only been within the past 4 to 5 years that the legislature is now getting away from the idea that we are rich. At first, they would not. It was like politics. Try to get money out of the legislature. Now, what happened to the billion is like asking what happened to the 910 million the state got in 1968. Nobody knows. There's no visible impact.
You're the only person I've met who's been to all of the villages in Alaska. I believe there are 244, and you've been to all of them.
220. 220,
okay.
I've been to 220. There are 244.
Okay. Well, you've been to a lot of those villages since 1971, I take it.
Yeah.
Well, is it possible for you to say in a general way, if you can, what the impact of ANCSA has been on Village Alaska? Is there any general remark that's suitable to...
No impact.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen any visible impact, other than the change in attitude. The problem that we ran into with the state agencies and the federal agencies was that there was a provision in the bill that would not negate federal responsibility, state responsibility, as a result of ANCSA. And the corporations were running. In the northern regions, they were having the problem of using their money to build roads, as an example. We did not intend to have that money used for public works projects. We did not want the federal estate to get off the hook. But they were doing it. The village corporations were doing it. Today, the state agencies, the legislature, Congress, is not providing the kind of support that the corporations need as they develop. In our region, a good example is that of the Heidelberg Grove and what's taking place in Huna. They're relying upon the corporation to build, punch in those roads using corporate funds. But yet, at the same time, you see the development that took place what they call the Hickle Highway up north. The state financed that.
You mean the road alongside the pipeline?
Yeah. At first, the companies, the Alyeska, or they were the ones that financed it. And then eventually the state paid them back. Now the state took it up. Well, right now, they're not providing any support to any of our corporations, with the exception of the Heidelberg Group. But it took a lot of lobby effort to get them to do it. A lot of lobby effort. The state is subtly, in my view, waking up to the fact that we are not millionaires and that there are more problems out there than you can shake a stick at. I was not sure what kinds of questions and answers you were looking for. I probably have more questions of you than you have of me.
Well, no, this has been very useful. We heard a little bit about limited entry last night, so it helps to have your views that, to round out that picture.
See, what happened with the with the scholarship programs, just after the claims settled and monies were coming across, the state and the federal agencies that deal in that area were reluctant to give any scholarship to any of our kids. The end result is that a lot of our kids, we put 468 children through school on the average a year, just from the Southeast, mind you. We graduate them at a rate of about 225. We have 11 that have earned doctorates. We have 47 that have master's degree. I don't know how many that have BA associate degrees. But it set us back 2 years. It did. It set us back 2 years. That's a long time. 2 years. In a kid's life, in a formative year, that's a long time.
It set it back because the kids were decided not to go on to university, is that it?
Well, if a youngster gets out of high school, you should immediately shove him into college or other institution of higher education before they get too used to the idea of hanging around. Well, a lot of them hung around because they couldn't get any scholarships. Now they're starting to award scholarships as of about 3 years ago. The state began to.
Oh, I see. The state reduced the program of scholarships.
Yes.
For Native kids after ANCSA. Oh, I see.
And the feds did as well. The Bureau of Indian Affairs did have a scholarship program. But if any organization such as the Alaska Native Brotherhood gave a scholarship to any of the kids, it would be reduced by the same amount as we presented, going on a basic need basis.
Mm-hmm.
So what were we doing? We weren't doing anything in the area of education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While we're talking, what have you found really among your travels?
Well, it's too early to say anything specific, but I have found that people are concerned about the land, about subsistence. As far as 1991 goes, a lot of villages have people say we should restrict the sale of shares so people can't sell their shares in 1991. We've got to do something to make sure our land isn't taxable in 1991. We've got to do something to make sure that children born since 1971 can participate in the settlement. And there's a movement throughout the state that keeps cropping up where we go for Native self-government, tribal government. Those are just the themes, you know, that the main themes that I keep hearing when I go to hold meetings anywhere in the state. Those are the main themes that come up. But
well, you have, what, 79 IRAs throughout the state? If they were to convert to IRAs, then we run the problem of having to go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs for permission of what to do.
Yes, well, that's, I've been, I was saying to...
But on the other hand, if we lose the land, then we've effectively lost what we fought for. See, a lot of the Congress people, federal people, they think that they gave us $1 billion and they gave us 44 million acres. Not so. The $1 billion to satisfy what we gave up, and we agreed to retain 44 million acres. Now, how are they going to convey that? And in 1991, I will wager that the selection process by the state or the regional or the village corporations are not yet going to be completed. So that 13-year provision is not in effect. Is not in effect. It was perceived that at least 13 years, it would take 13 years for the corporations to stand on its own.
So you say 13 years. Where do you get 13 years from?
That was the expectation of the Congress, that it would take that long for the village corporations to stand on their own. 1991 provision came in.
But how do you get 1991 out of 13 years? That's what I don't understand.
They figured that it would take about 6-7 years for the money to even start flowing.
I see.
And once it starts flowing, then at least another 30 years. Now, the problem that we ran with the village corporations, the urban corporations, and the regional corporations is that there was too much to try to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Just because Doyle was buying the corporation, we felt like we had to buy a corporation too. We'd have done better if we had been provided an education for the first 6 years on what it takes to be a corporation and live on a 9% return on interest than a 1% return or loss, as it turns out. The risk factor of investment. We were realizing no more than 1 or 2% return on our investments. Whereas if we put it into securities, bonds, for the first 6 years and then teach us how to become corporate executives, so to speak, how to run a corporation. The other problem that we're running now is it's too much of a popularity contest. We don't have the business minds serving on those boards that are running these 13 corporations in the Southeast. That's the problem. Too much popularity. Too many agency types like me. If you give me a budget of $212,000, I'll figure out how to spend it in 12 months. But you told me to make $212,000 in 1 year. That's another thing. We're too budget minded. Mm-hmm. Not enough in the way of business experience. Too many agency types. The state and federal agencies are of no help that I can see to the village corporations or the urban corporations. They're having to do it on their own. There are some China programs that are taking place by Klukwan, by Huna, Goldbelt. They're paying those things on their own, with very little participation on the part of the professionals that need to come in. Now, where is the National Alliance of Businessmen? I'd like to know. In the lower 48 states, they are present. They're there. They have qualified people from the Louisiana Pacific. They can send up, teach us, wirehouse it. They can teach us. They can show us how to do these things. But where are they? I don't see it. This logging operation that we live in, that's a lot of front money. You can go broke in no time at all.
What logging operation is that?
We have logging operations going in Long Island, over in Honau, Prince of Wales, Hobart Bay. A lot of front money. You got to put up the front money. And you have to wait a long time for your return. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. Willard, I'm glad you found time.
I wish I had more time, but yeah. My inspector is getting ready to leave in about half an hour.
Okay, well, we'll excuse you then and want to thank...
I wish I could have reacted to some of the things that... I don't know if you had any input at all from the state people or from any of the federal people.
Bob Arnold over here yesterday to testify.
Bob was one of those that wrote the final bill. Mm-hmm. What was eventually the final bill. He was one of the framers.
And at Anchorage, we had Doug Jones, who was an assistant to Gravel. We had William Van Ness, who was an assistant to Jackson. And we had...
the Federal Field Committee.
We had Guy Martin, who was... We also had Dave Hickok testifying, so we heard a lot of the background.
Yeah, those were the Federal Field Committee people. Esther Wanneke, she's now commissioner up here. She was on that Federal Field Committee. Dr. Fitzgerald, he was also. Dr. Fitzgerald, I don't know whether you've heard from him.
Well, we asked him to come, but he's retired, living in Montana now, and I gather he's not a young man any longer, so he wasn't able to make it.
But they wrote the final bill. See, we went through nine different bills as we were going through that. The first bill that was introduced was a ridiculous bill by the Interior Department. They were, after it was all over and said and done, they were even embarrassed by their own bill. And I know who wrote it. He happened to be our attorney for quite a number of years. But the Federal Field Committee bill was the one that finally ended up. As to where we're going and what's wrong with the corporations, I won't delve into that. I stay out of politics.
Okay, well, I want to thank the ANB for letting us use the facilities here in the hall.
Well, I hope we didn't inconvenience you. You know, we
no.
got other activity going on.
No, this has been very, very good, very fine. And I think we can adjourn now till 7:30 this evening. Just a second.
I would like to make a short statement.
Sure, please do. Yep.
Second, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Willard.
My name is Miles Murphy, Mayor of City of Hoonah. One of the
statements Mr. Willard made was that the state wouldn't come out to Hoonah to build roads. Hoonah never requested the state to do this. This is a joint venture between the Forest Service and the corporation, and it was a logging road. It was not a public road. Secondly, the land involved, and that is the reason why we didn't ask the state, was the ownership of that land is in doubt due to this over-selection that Sea Alaska is entitled to. So we don't know who's going to own that land tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So the state was reluctant to come in. We knew they would be, so we didn't bother asking them. The other statement that was made, or you asked him a question, I'd like to respond to that, is do you think the people would show their shares in 1991? Right now, at least the circle of friends I hang around with, people I hang around with, say, hey, we'll sell it right now if we could. And there's a reason for that. I mentioned this morning that the corporation is putting people to work. Some of the shareholders are making money. The corporation is not. They're out there borrowing money. I heard him mention front money. I don't know who he's talking about, where he got that front money from to get the logging operation. But in Hoonah Corporation's case, the National Lands Bank. And they borrow so many millions to start the logging operation. But they don't make that amount of money to pay bank that loan, so it's a never-ending thing. They're losing the land as collateral. The rate we're going now, National Land Bank can own all the land. So that's why some people say, hey, well, we can do it now, we'd sell it right now. Because there may not be nothing left to sell in 1991. And that's a strong feeling that quite a few of the people have on that. I think Kowak and Craig took a wise move here, I think it was last year, when they gave each shareholder a plot of land. They got something out of it. And this is what we tried to do there, but some of these people that have been elected say, oh no, we can't do that, we're getting rid of our assets. They're going to lose it anyway, the rate they're going. So I think that's the only solution right now, is give each shareholder a piece of land and let them do what he wants. We could lose the money just as fast as they could, only we'd enjoy losing it. Then I'm going to save it.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Can I just add one comment from the chair?
All right, from the chair.
Yes, he touched on the villages, you know, and it reminded me of how I got our village revitalized again in Skagway. And we went to the traditional way because from our experiences that we've gotten from the federal government, we thought we'd be better off going with our traditional village council and the IRA, because we didn't want to be tied up and bound up by the federal laws, and we didn't feel that why should we ask somebody else to operate or to control or govern our own self when we've been doing this from time immemorial. And if we reenacted with the IRA, then we'd have to be stuck by their laws. And then it wouldn't be the same as what we were used to. We will comply with other laws as we see fit that would help us, and we won't do anything that will offend anybody else's laws, but we wanted to govern our own self. So that's why I went to traditional way of government, because that's the only two things they had for where there was a IRA council that they recognized first, because it's federal. But, and I'm having trouble right now in getting recognized as a traditional council. There's probably two traditional councils, I might be wrong, in Alaska. One, there's one up in the interior, or maybe two up there in our village in Skagway. But now we have to prove that we are traditional. And I don't know why the federal government have to prove to them, because we are the people. And unwritten laws, it's hard to come up, because our forefathers passed down these things and stories, and I'm having a hard time, like I testified before, to prove that we are the people we are. But nevertheless, we decided we'd stay with the traditional council, because we don't think the IRA thing and stuff is going to be the, eventually it's not going to be IRAs anymore. Everybody's going to go back to the traditional way and get away from the federal spikes going into us.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Okay, hello, my name is Salku Du'u, Victoria Man Angelo. I am Shendu Katie of the Thunderbird Clan. Is that coming in okay?
Yep.
I am speaking to you today not as a scholar of the land claims, but as a messenger. The true scholars, our elders, are dying. I wish my grandmother, Lily Clinot Nye, Mary Clinot White, and Annie White were here to tell you about the land, not developing, corporation, money, and I don't want to get too mad today because I always get mad when I talk about this issue. And what it meant to them. Developing, sorry, but I got a really bad sore throat. Developing to them wasn't logging, improving, building roads, building skyscrapers, but leaving the land alone and letting nature take its course was their way of life. Thank you. My grandmother once told us all never to cut down a tree unless you're going to build a cabin. And I still believe in that concept. Okay. I often wonder just how great subsistence laws, TV, limited entry, and have they really helped? Limited entry. Why are our waters full of out-of-state fishermen?
Out-of-state.
Out-of-state. Mm-hmm. And if you want to see something really pathetic, go up to Haines's Fall. It's loaded with out-of-state people. And my brother has been fighting it for years. And he is a commercial fisherman. My uncles are commercial fishermen. My grandfather was a commercial fisherman. After X number of years, who can prove who was who? And this is talking about allotments. I think that was one of the good things about the land claims. After so many years, how can you prove who was who in court? And it gets worse, and it gets worse, and I've been going through with it for many years. And as the years pass, it gets harder and harder, and it's all paperwork. Which most people don't like, which most natives don't know about and don't like and ignore. Wealth is not money, wealth is land, wealth is living on that land. Wealth is not depending on the federal or state for help. Wealth is being left alone to live as we once lived, which is nowadays probably a true fantasy, but I would like to see it happen. I'd like to strive for it. And would like to teach the children this. I am sad because there weren't enough of us 100 years ago to keep the Chilkat Valley and the rest of Alaska free. I'm sad because Alaska became a territory. I'm sad because Alaska became a state. I'm sad when I look at our forest and our population growth. I'm sad when I think of our children and their future. And I think that's about all I have to say for now.
Thank you very much.
I think I had more, but that's good enough for now.
Okay.
I hate speaking in microphones.
If you decide to add something, we'll be back here at 7:30 tonight. And in any event, you can always send something in writing to us.
Oh, yeah, maybe I'll do that. Yeah. I didn't even know about this till yesterday.
Well.
And so I came here last night to see people's views, and they kind of got carried away, so I thought I'd just come by when it wasn't so crowded.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. Well, we'll adjourn till 7:30 tonight. I'll, first of all, my name is Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission, and I think you all know what our job is. We're looking into the Claim Settlement Act of 1971, its impact, the 1991 issues, all the broad questions of native land and governance that I know are concerning Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally today. I should apologize for being late this evening. I want to welcome you. This is our last evening here in Juneau, and we've had 3 days of, I think, very useful testimony and discussion. With me is Jeff Berliner, who is taking down everything that is said on tape. I think you all know Eileen McLean, who works with the commission and has helped to organize these meetings. And I think you know Bill Hess of the Tundra Times. And we are happy to be here, and we're going to Sitka tomorrow to hold hearings there, and then to Angoon on Saturday, and then Ketchikan Monday, and Kluwak on Thursday next week. And then we're going to spend a day in Metlakatla to see how things have worked out there. So that is our itinerary for Southeast Alaska, and if the meetings are as useful in these other places as they've been in Juneau these last 3 days, then we'll be very well pleased. So if you wish to make a presentation, if you wouldn't mind just coming and sitting here by this microphone to my right so that what you say will be picked up on tape and then transcribed. And all that is said is going to be typed up and printed in a series of transcripts that will be deposited at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, but will be available. Indeed, we intend to send copies to local Native organizations at each place that we visit. And at the end of these meetings, that will take us, I think, throughout every region in Alaska for the remainder of the year. At the end of that process, I intend to write a report that will be made public in the fall, in the summer of 1985, and copies will be sent to all the people who testified. And somebody pointed out to me this afternoon that without the addresses of everyone who testified, that might be a little difficult. And I confess that hadn't occurred to me, but I'm sure we'll work that out one way or the other. So if you would like to speak to this whole subject, please feel free to take the seat here, and we're open for business.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Vorbridge. I appear today in my private capacity as a Tlingit Indian and a shareholder in the Sea Alaska Corporation and the Gold Belt Corporation. My comments will be from the perspective of my previous service as president of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council, the first chairman and president of Sea Alaska Corporation, the first vice president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, and a commissioner on the American Indian Policy Review Commission. It was also my privilege to be associated with a number of other people throughout the state who were framers of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. When the Alaska Federation of Natives was founded in 1966. The Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts of Alaska had lost millions of acres of their valuable lands. All of this despite the disclaimer clause in the Alaska State Constitution, which promised to maintain the status quo as pertained to the definition of those land rights until Congress acted at some undetermined time in the future. So we started off quite early with a broken promise and the pressures that seemed to indicate more land losses would occur. Pressures by the state of Alaska to complete its selection of 104 plus million acres, and pressures to transport the oil discovered on the North Slope to an ice-free port in southern Alaska posed threats to the natives who were fighting to prevent further land losses. And after several years of intense and difficult lobbying, AFN and the Native Regional Corporations persuaded the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and President Nixon to enact and to sign into law a Native Land Claims Settlement Act. It's important, with respect to the comments I will be making, to gain a sense of urgency that existed in those days and to appreciate what the stakes were at the time. ANCSA was a compromise that was shaped by the U.S. House of Representatives, the United States Senate, the Department of Interior representing the administration of President Nixon, the state of Alaska, the oil company, the timber industry, the mining industry, the Alaska business community, the environmentalists, the natives, and uncounted others. It's interesting not only to enumerate those interested parties and entities that helped to shape the law that finally emerged, but it's also interesting to appreciate that although the title is Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, in terms of its actual beneficiaries, the law went far beyond the Alaska Natives. The beneficiaries were the state of Alaska, which upon passage of the law was able to continue with the selection of the lands to which it felt it was entitled under the Statehood Act. Also a beneficiary were the oil companies and the people in the United States and the rest of the world who wanted the oil for energy that existed and was to be found under lands claimed by the Alaska Natives. Also beneficiaries were people in the entire United States who were concerned about classification of lands and the preservation of some of the unique values to be found in the Alaskan wilderness. So in the give and take of the congressional lawmaking process, some of the major provisions sought by the natives were either modified or omitted. Among these, I number stronger subsistence provisions. The legislative history is quite clear in that the provisions pertaining to native subsistence use found in the earlier bill passed by the Senate were much more detailed and stronger than those which were found in the House version and which were finally enacted after free conference deliberations involving representatives from both houses of Congress. Also modified considerably was a Native proposal for a perpetual 2% override. I think the decision there to modify that from perpetual to a limitation of 500 million was based purely on the feeling that the natives were going to receive a great deal of money. I considered the modification an unjust one, but still in terms of negotiations, the natives did quite well. Also considered were selections of economically valuable non-contiguous lands, which is to say non-contiguous to the village lands themselves. Also considered were in lieu selections, which meant selections made in other areas of the state when, due to various reasons, land could not be selected immediately contiguous to the villages themselves. ANCSA, the law, as amended by omnibus legislation in 1976, and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980, known as ANILCA, is a tool in the hands of the Alaska Natives. It does not pretend to be, nor was it ever intended to be, the final answer for the Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts of this state. There can be no final answer in terms of our progress, in terms of our response to the pressures which we feel as they focus on our culture, our use of the land, and the other things that go into making our makeup as a people. This law does not pretend to be and was not ever intended to be, I reemphasize, to be the final answer. Complex laws relating to the human condition tend to become outdated and obsolete in part. All we have to do is look at the Constitution of the United States and to appreciate that one of the most important facets of that basic supreme law of the land is a provision for amendment, which the Founding Fathers realized would be inevitable as our nation grew. ANCSA is no exception. It is a law that can be improved by amendments, or it is a law whose effect can be improved by other laws, or through improvements in its administration. But a responsible leadership seeking such improvement should not overlook what ANCSA accomplished. I state this specifically not as a condemnation of the frustration that many of us feel and have shared with respect to frustration about what is happening to our land, or about our corporations, or about our subsistence rights, or about many of the rights that we as Native people had exercised in the past, but which we now find to be gradually more and more restricted. But rather, I feel that those who do not look to the past and look to history to understand it will, to use a well-known phrase, be condemned to repeat its mistakes. So here is what I see that ANCSA accomplished, as I reduce its accomplishments to four primary ones. Number one, it stopped then ongoing Native land losses by confirming title to more than 40 million acres. Two, it set the stage for the protection of our Native subsistence rights, which battle went on throughout the consideration of two versions of a land claims bill in the House and the Senate, and which battle was fought out in the conference committee deliberations following passage of different versions of the bill in each of the two houses. And finally, that provision was further modified or amended by the ANILCA subsistence provision. So this provision, which finally received such great prominence and attention in ANILCA, was a result of a process that went on for several years' time. ANCSA also provided for a total payment of $962.5 million as compensation for the extinction.